Radio. This is Pet Life Radio. Let's talk pets.
Yes, us, everybody. You know the drill. We've started this podcast to help anybody who's remotely interested in trapping and neutering animals. We're the help we didn't receive when we first wanted to get involved, and we want to be your new friends in the TNR world. I'm Adele, one of your hosts for this episode, and I'm so excited to welcome Anupriya back for a part two of our podcast. Hello. So Anupriya is from Dogs of Delhi Spay and Neuter, and is an animal rights activist and vegan rescue founder. They are based in London and run a large-scale spay and neuter program for community animals in Delhi NCR, which over the last 8 years has successfully sterilized over 34,000 dogs and cats. And along with this, they run another initiative that focuses on facilitating adoptions for rescued, abandoned, and abused companion animals called Paws for a Cause NCR. Anupriya has worked as a volunteer at multiple animal sanctuaries that focus on farmed animal species as well. Welcome back. Glad to have you and hear from you again.
Thank you. I'm glad to be back.
So today we wanted to discuss a little bit more theoretically, something we talk about a lot as friends and co-charity runners, so to say, is decision making. There are a lot of decisions that we have to make either quickly or under pressure that affect all different kinds of things, our finances, our resources, our vet clinics, our volunteers, our fosterers, the future of that animal. So it's a very complicated process, but we often have to do it very quickly and it becomes kind of intuitive. So perhaps today we can talk about breaking that down a little bit and figuring out how to make good decisions that are in the best interest of the animals in our care. So one of the things we've discussed is how to approach treatment of animals. So while our primary focus is spay and neuter, we are inevitably going to find animals that need extra care in the field, right? What are some of the most common issues that you and your team discover animals suffering from when they're going out to catch them for spay and neuter and take them to the clinic, but they've got something else happening?
So we come across lots of ailing animals because, as I said in the previous episode, we target areas that are quite neglected, do not necessarily have caregivers attached to these animals. So we end up getting a lot of maggot wounds that have become atrociously large. They probably started out as tiny little holes that could have been treated. But because there's neglect, we've had like full, you know, in the entire skull, neck, shoulder, skin's just been chewed up by maggots. Very, very common. Often in the genitalia, there'll be maggots, which is really painful, uncomfortable, hard to treat because of the infection involved. So maggot wounds is one of them. Intentional brutality is also something, sadly, that we come across quite a lot in certain areas. We have, as we've talked about many times, I think, privately before, is TBT, something people don't really, it's a sexually transmitted infection, again, very common. Skin infections, very common, and thankfully quite easy to treat most of the time. And viruses. So viruses are the hardest in terms of really treating them properly, both for cats and dogs. Parvo and distemper in dogs is very, very common on the streets of Delhi, and feline panleukopenia is very, very common as well on the streets of Delhi. Not just on the streets, a lot of the caregivers we help actually have indoor-outdoor cats that they tend to keep taking in to their house, and often these are cats from several different litters. They're being exposed to each other, and often if one of them has FPV, all of them have FPV. So very, very common as well. So fractures, yeah, is probably the last most common issue that we come across. Okay.
So this question of infectious diseases and viruses and things like that, which is really common no matter what country you're in. And there are certain ones like parvo, like distemper, like panleukopenia and distemper and things like that, that are really deadly and contagious. and not necessarily zoonotic, but can be very deadly for the animals in our care. And if we are also considering taking them to a clinic, exposing them to other animals who are in that clinic, that could be a whole mess. So this might be one of the things that is really difficult to make a decision about if you find animals who are sick suffering from this. What would be your kind of approach to dealing with this kind of thing, whether you intend, like your intention is to go out and pick them up for spay and neuter, or you're just like counting or surveying or something like that? How would you approach when you find these issues?
So I'm going to tell you how I approach them, but also my general advice. I think you should only try to treat an issue if you have the bandwidth and the funds. A lot of people that I work with work really out of pure emotion and tend to pick up animals. So they'll see a sick animal. They very obviously have an infection. They'll have leaky eyes. They'll have, you know, yellow, green discharge coming out of their nose, and they'll take them home. Usually these people already have animals in their house, not necessarily all vaccinated, and vaccinations are not 100%. They don't necessarily protect an animal 100%. There's different strains of FPV, and I actually have started to really understand these strains. Every year we have a different kind of strain and we know exactly what kind of symptoms to expect, etc. I would say only pick up an animal if you really want to follow through, and that means don't risk your existing responsibilities. So only pick them up if you have a space to isolate them, and make sure when you're taking them into a clinic, because our vets are not very careful about really wiping their surfaces, making sure their own nails and hands are clean. Often a lot of hands will touch the animals. So the vet, their assistants, the table, their tools, their thermometers, and they'll go right into the bum of another cat, you know, immediately transmitting disease. So when we're taking on the responsibility of a sick, infectious animal, we're really taking on the responsibility of everybody we're exposing them to as well. So while we very rarely euthanize for anything like an FPV, a distemper, a parvo, we treat them because they're highly treatable infections. They're really not hard to treat. If you know the treatment, they're very easy to treat. And if you get them on time, if they're obviously too far gone, they've really gone into the neurological stage, it's harder. But these are really resilient animals. The dogs on the streets of Delhi and the cats in the streets of Delhi are not fragile animals. They're quite resilient. So you can treat them, but you have to make sure you're following every single protocol. So we very can't remember a time I've euthanized for FPV, honestly. But they have a high survival rate. Then there's a standard treatment. It's not even case to case. If you know this animal has FPV, very easy to test for. You can do it yourself with a little poop. And yeah, you can treat them and make sure there's an isolated spot. There's a foster involved who knows the protocols to be followed. And secondly, if funds were no bar in Delhi, then there are hospitals that have FPV specific wards. Or have parvo and distemper specific wards. So you can get them admitted and they usually do a decent job treating them. It's just that they're very, very expensive.
That's really interesting that clinics have specific areas for animals with these illnesses. And perhaps it shows how common they are, but also how dedicated they have to be to treating them. Because to your point, you can treat them. It just has to be done properly. And so this is why we talk about having proper protocols around biosecurity and disinfection. Like you mentioned, making sure vet clinics are cleaning all their surfaces properly and not actively transmitting things between each animals and themselves in the cases of like Giardia and other types of parasites, which we can get ourselves.
Yeah.
And the fosters as well. So like you said, making sure that our fosters are going to follow protocols and keep the animals safe and the other animals in their care safe as well by following biosecurity protocols. And if we don't have these kinds of things in place, it makes it a lot more difficult to pick up and properly treat an animal. So I really like that you outlined that.
Absolutely. And what happens, what I've seen is as soon as people become lax with that protocol, they end up having two other sick animals. They'll expend all their resources and usually none of them will make it, you know. So you really have to make sure you're doing, you know what you're doing, and take the right advice.
Definitely. And I like what you've described, because I think a lot of people myself included in the past, have looked at things like FPV and thought, oh no, like, what can I do safely in this situation? Because it's so dangerous for the individual. Like, they could suffer a lot through the process. Can I safely put them back? Like, how long are they going to be in quarantine before they're safe to be with other animals? And because you've researched it and you understand, like you said, all the different strains and what the proper treatment is, that's really helpful in knowing what we can and can't treat and making decisions about this. FELV is something similar to this, right? Like, in the past, a lot of, especially Global North organizations and shelters, if they have animals who test positive, even for FIV, which we know animals can live with a lot of the times for many years healthily. And the same is being discovered about FELV as well. Like, yes, if they're very symptomatic, this is a problem. There's probably a lot of suffering and higher contagion risk. But if they're not symptomatic, they could have a few good years left in them still.
Yeah, absolutely.
What about decision-making around animals who have these viruses, which are viruses for life, which may or may not be contagious at different periods of time, based on like the symptoms they're experiencing and then how they've recovered, and also depending on the virus? How do you approach returning animals into the community and the decision-making around that with different conditions? Like an FELV cat, for example, they may not be symptomatic now, but they might be in the future. And, you know, there's risk with that. How do you approach that kind of thinking?
So FELV and FIV is not routinely tested in Delhi clinics the way it is in London. So here, when I do cat rescue, that's the first test we put them through. Usually when we've had to test for something like that, it's been when they were highly symptomatic. We do not do it as routine. Most vets do not even have the, you know, the test with them. I really had to source it from elsewhere when I wanted to do it. In those cases where I feel there's a risk of a bite or there's risk of cross-transmission, and these haven't had that many cases, but luckily where I have had them, they haven't been highly symptomatic. They've been friendly enough that we've been able to get them adopted into cat only, as an only cat in homes. I know that I don't know if I would absolutely not consider releasing an FELV positive cat, just because the transmission is really, you need a deep bite, I think, to transmit it. So I think an asymptomatic FELV positive cat with a caregiver, I think, could be a case for release, but I may be wrong.
So it sounds like,
yeah, for a friendly cat, we would get them adopted. And our adoptions are indoor only, very strictly so. So that would be ideal case scenario. But if this was a really feral cat, then I would have to.
So it sounds like some things we're taking into consideration is whether the cat is currently sick. Obviously, if we're going to return an animal outside, they should be recovered from whatever they were struggling with. And we should have diagnosed that and treated it properly. If we're not sure, we shouldn't just be returning them back outside. And other factors as well. You mentioned, like, if they have a caregiver, this makes it even more likely that we return them back outside, because we know they're going to be receiving care. And in the future, if they start to decline, they'll be able to pick up on that and make an end of life decision if necessary. And access to resources and things like that all coming into play of making that decision. What about, you mentioned TVT before. And for anybody that's not familiar with this, this is transmissible venereal tumors. That's what TVT stands for. It's predominantly in canines, and it's in a lot of like Southeast Asia, all the way across to India as well, but not so much in other countries like the Global North or Europe and things like that. So that's why people are less familiar with it. But it's something that needs to be treated with chemotherapy, right? It's something that creates tumors, and these can become like physical issues that need to be like removed from surgery and things like that. So if you find an animal with TVT, either, you know, on your route to take dogs for sterilization, or they're one of the dogs that you intended to sterilize that day, how would you approach that?
We have them boarded. So they undergo several sessions of chemotherapy until they recover, are sterilized, and only then they're released back. So they're not treated on site or anything like that, and they're not spayed, of course, immediately. So we only treat them inpatient in hospitals. Usually it's a few weeks of care where they undergo several sessions of chemotherapy, and they also, because they're undergoing chemotherapy, they will need some supportive care as well, because chemo is hard on anybody. So they get all of that, they get sterilized, they get vaccinated, and then they're released back.
Cool. So it's a proper commitment. It's, you know, yeah, several weeks of recovery. There are other animals that take longer to recover from that. So as you said before, it's something that, yes, it will cause great suffering if it's not treated. And it's a risk to other dogs as well if they're not sterilized, which is yet another reason to spay and neuter all of them to reduce this risk, because it comes from mating, from physical contact. But yeah, it's a huge commitment. So we need to make sure that we can actually do it properly and know what we're getting into.
Yes. And funds are important, because it's not cheap. We could sterilize many more dogs with that money. So that's a consideration.
That's something that we discuss a lot, like especially when we're talking about areas that have huge numbers of animals that need to be sterilized, and trying to weigh up the right decision when it comes to, we have a limited amount of funds. And we have all these animals that we need to sterilize. So kind of what you just mentioned, like something like TBT is going to be much more expensive, and we have to board them and it's prolonged care. How do you generally approach that? Like, where we're allocating funds for sterilization versus treatment and keeping the balance of that?
We never compromise on sterilization. So when possible, when I'm able to pick up an animal, they're going to get sterilized. So we figure out the funds. It's a very, we will manage kind of approach. But treatments, it really depends. So as much as possible, we want to minimize costs. We want to minimize trauma. So when possible, we will try to treat them on site, which helps minimize costs. You know, it's usually just a volunteer who's medicating them, treating them. But in most cases where we've kind of adopted a village or adopted an area, if we do find ailing animals, like with TDT or with gaping maggot wounds, we treat them. But if I had to make a choice, it would, the funds, our primary cause and our primary goal is spay and neuter. So that's where the funds. So I would not take funds out of the spay neuter bucket to put into a treatment. Treatments are done extra. In some cases, volunteers who are caregivers who are looking after these dogs will pitch in for the treatment. So they'll just ask us for help. So they're like, you know, we've got, you sterilize these 9 dogs, we pay for them. But we also want to send this 10th dog who's got XYZ issue. Could you treat them? And we'll pitch in 50%, and usually we agree to that. So we do try to get some accountability out of people on site as well. And most people who've got some kind of attachment to these animals will try to fundraise. It's usually easier for individuals to fundraise versus us, because people have this view of organizations as people that have funds. We really don't. Most of it is our private funding that goes in. So we do try to keep people as accountable as possible to their animals.
Awesome. Well, we're going to take a very quick break, and then we're going to be back to talk a little bit more.
Real people, real stories.
Our little dog developed this lymph problem. But the chemotherapy lasted for 6 months, started developing more lymph nodes. So I thought I'd just try carnivore. The lymph nodes started to go down. Then I took him into the vet to have him checked out, and there was no signs at all inside.
My cat had issues that developed in his eye, and 3 months later, my veterinarian said, let's go ahead and remove the eye. I heard the carnivore on advertising. So I said, you know what? I'm going to order this product. They did the procedure. They did all the tests, and they said, I don't know what you did. This product saved his eye.
I've got a Labrador. He could hardly lift herself up off the floor. The treatment was chemotherapy. That's when I said, this could be the ticket. About 3 weeks, you could tell she was very alert. She was going on 5-mile walk. She is just like prime again.
Call 866-836-8735. That's 866-836-8735. Or visit carnivore.com. That's carnivora.com.
Use promo code PETLIFE at checkout for 15% off your order at carnivora.com.
Let's talk pets.
Let's talk pets.
On Pet Life Radio.
Pet Life Radio.
PetLifeRadio.com.
Okay, we are back. This is the difficult part of decision making, because we want to try to make as practical and rational decisions as possible so that we can focus on the goal that we have specifically set out the want to achieve, which is preventing reproduction, preventing these viruses from spreading, and all of these different health issues that animals come across if they are not spay and neutered. but it's something that you mentioned last episode as well, is it's really difficult not to make an emotional decision because we do this work because of our empathy and we see animals suffering in front of us and we want to help. And the reason we've come to spay and neuter is because we've made a logical, rational choice of the best way I can help the most amount of animals is with spay and neuter. It's an investment in the rest of their life. And yes, it is difficult to turn away from one individual who is suffering. It's just a challenging part of that decision-making process and making sure that we are making choices that are sustainable and that are going to help the most amount of individuals possible. And it doesn't mean turning off our empathy. It doesn't mean turning away animals. You obviously treat a huge amount of animals, but there's always going to be more to treat and there's always going to be more to spay and neuter. So we have to figure out what the most logical choice is for us, for our community and for the resources that we have.
Yeah. And also you see that immediately because they're not reproducing once in 3 years. They're reproducing, the cats are reproducing every, they get pregnant while they're still nursing. The dogs are having 2 litters a year. So people see that. They see that if we don't, you know, put our energy and funds into this, this is the next thing that's going to happen. These puppies are going to suffer. It's a loop. So my focus is spay and neuter and also vaccinations, because that already prevents a lot of this potential for viruses and diseases. But luckily, we've been lucky enough that we've been able to do a lot of treatments. So we do try to treat really as many as we can. But I know it's hard for private individuals to do that at that scale.
This is a decision-making question we've discussed as well, is the topic of vaccinations, especially in Greece. I think most people make the decision of, I can either sterilize and vaccinate and do half the number of animals, or I can just sterilize and do double, which it's not quite like, that's not quite the practical lens to look at it through. It's not like I either do less or I do more, but in a lot of cases, the vaccination is double the cost of the sterilization cost. So how do you approach that? How do you justify the investment in vaccines over sterilizing more animals?
Okay, so vaccination costs for me are not double of the sterilization cost. So on average, a vaccine costs around 270 rupees, which is like £2.5. A DHPPI vaccine, which is for the puppies. They get two to three for each puppy. We just keep separate funding for that just because I've seen the amount of suffering and I've seen if I've committed to certain areas and I've committed to certain volunteers, at least for some areas. Not everywhere do we do this. Not everywhere do we vaccinate beforehand. But in some areas where I know I can trust the local volunteers to manage the correct documentation, no like double vaccinations, no sort of over vaccinating, making sure we're monitoring them for any kind of post-vaccine issues, etc. We do it. So for them, we do it. But there are areas where we just can't catch them twice, you know. There I will, of course, still spay and neuter. I won't just not do it. But because I've seen the amount of suffering and we do have the means to do it, and it's not that expensive because we buy them from the suppliers, so we don't get a vet to provide them to us because vets charge like 500% profit on vaccines. We go to the producers, so MDS or whatever, the Novavax producers, and we buy them at almost cost price. And we have trained volunteers who have got part of vet training that administer vaccines. I can do it as well. So when I go, I vaccinate them. So that's how we try to minimize costs around vaccines. Again, something that needs training. It's a skill, making sure there's cold chain maintenance. You're not just like keeping vaccines in a box and transporting them. Delhi gets very, very hot. So there's a lot of training. There's a lot of constantly making sure protocols are being followed. But I view vaccines as preventative and necessary care, but I understand that that's not always possible. And if I were given a choice and I only had limited funds, I would put them into spay and neuter as well.
Yeah, I mean, those are really good points. Like going to suppliers is going to make things cheaper rather than just relying on vet clinics to provide us everything, and perhaps even learning to administer vaccines on our own as well. That could be a potential skill. Obviously, not every animal is handleable, especially if we're dealing with a lot of
exactly
feral cats and dogs. And so we are reliant, but that doesn't we are reliant on the vets providing the vaccines, but that doesn't mean we can't give the vaccines to the vets that we've purchased. So I think to your point, like working within our means, but trying to find ways in order to do the best job possible and being creative with that. So those are good ideas. To your point, what do you do when you're going out to survey or pick up dogs for their sterilization trip and you find kittens and puppies and the people in the neighborhood are like, please take them. We don't know what to do with them. We need you to rescue them. Or your volunteers are like, can we take them? What should we do with them? What's the solution here? What do you usually decide?
I mean, it really depends on why they want them taken away. Is it just because they don't want them there? Is it because they're sad about their suffering? We make a very hard line. We're only here to sterilize these animals. We're not here to take anyone away. We're bringing them right back to you. If there's a mother and if there are siblings, then we do not displace animals at all. So if they have a mom, they already have a high chance of survival. The mom's going to teach them the skills needed. They're going to be at the same risk level as any other dog born on the streets, any other cat born on the streets. So if they've got a family, definitely not. If this is an isolated puppy who's somehow been, a lot of times people will pick up and pluck puppies and kittens from litters just because they were cute, and then go dump them elsewhere. And then that really lowers their risk of survival. So they'll take them because they're cute. They'll play with them for a few hours, understand that this is not a toy, dump them elsewhere. This is something that's very common. When that happens, that's, a decision-making thing. Do you have the means to really rescue and commit to an entire individual? So if a volunteer tells me, hey, can we take these puppies? I tell them, go ahead and take that responsibility yourself, you know, because I really limit the number of rescues we do. Obviously, that doesn't mean we don't. I always have some animals up for adoption that are directly being cared for by my organization specifically, and we're looking after them in foster care. But our primary goal is never to take them. So we always counsel the people, make them understand that just plucking animals off the streets is not, there's not enough homes, and that's not going to help them. Putting them in a shelter is a death sentence most of the time. These are unvaccinated animals. If they don't succumb to viruses, they succumb to depression. They succumb to just like being, you know, there's a lot of competition between shelter animals for food, etc. There's not enough individual care. So really, shelters are not an option. There are not enough foster/adoptive homes. So really, it's a huge commitment and decision when you take an animal off the streets, and often it's a disservice to them. So we do counsel people against that as and when possible. Most of our volunteers that are kind of permanent volunteers have a lot of experience in this. So they understand and know when to make that decision. And usually they will also commit to the animals themselves. That doesn't necessarily mean they'll come under our care. In some cases, they do come under our care, but it's really a decision made around our bandwidth in that moment in terms of funds, in terms of time, because I get involved and then I need to have the time. I have a full-time job, you know, so I need to have the time to make sure I can coordinate all the things this individual needs right now, which I can't always do.
Yeah, so these decisions affect way more than the animal, ourselves. They affect our whole team, the future of our organization's work, where we allocate resources, the other animals in our care. So that's why it's so important to put so much time into thinking about how we do our decision making.
Yes.
Because as you said, another viable option is vaccinate them, put them on a schedule for sterilization when they're old enough, and keep them in the community to be community dogs and cats.
Yeah. Like I took a emotional decision last April to take Blackie in. Blackie was reported to me by a volunteer that I really care about. She's amazing. She does incredible work. I normally don't end up saying no to her because I know she takes, you know, sensible decisions. But he's a cat, a black cat with, and I hate his name, so I changed it to Coco because I think it's a stupid fucking name. So he's called Coco now, and Coco has horrible, he had this horrible wound across his neck and head. But it's a maggot wound. Maggot wounds heal. So I was like, cool, let's take him in. I've got some funds and I'll allocate this to him and he will be fine. He is the slowest healer in the world. His wound does not heal. He has still not healed 16 months later because he keeps like rubbing himself over things and like reopening that wound up. He's now in foster care, but he spent 14 months in the hospital. That's the longest I've ever had any animal stay in a hospital. We spent over £1,000, I think over £1,200 on him. I could have sterilized so many animals. right? But once I'd taken that responsibility, I wasn't going to put him back. And we just kept going. And now he can't be released because he's just so used to an indoor environment. So we're actually looking for a home for him. But
yeah, that's a huge commitment.
Yeah, it's a lot of money.
And unexpected as well, right? Yeah. You said you thought it was going to be simple.
I thought it was going to be 2 months. Yeah.
And that's possible, right? That's completely possible when we work in animal rescue. And I think this is a really important message, not just for rescuers, but also tourists and international organizations who have more means than smaller grassroots organizations who have less means to take in an animal because a tourist has found them and feels this emotional pull to do something for this animal that they've seen suffering and they've decided, like, for them to feel better, this animal needs to go inside, whether it's a perfectly healthy puppy or someone who actually does have like a health condition that needs support. Ultimately, this is everywhere. And the reality of taking this animal from the street or even asking an organization to take this animal from the street, the guilt that you put on them with all of the other decisions they have to make from people who contact them every single day, they either have to say yes or no. And if they say yes, it's a whole thing of trying to figure out how to get the resources to help this animal for the rest of their life. And yes, it is great when people want to donate, but it is not going to cover the rest of their life and the potentially 16 months that need to go into a very basic treatment for one animal, which you didn't predict.
Yeah, we've had tourists do that, dump animals on us after committing to them. So yeah, it's a story for offline. But but yeah, we've had prominent rescue founders from abroad come and, you know, feel emotionally attached to a puppy, ask us, and we trusted them because we thought they understand rescue. But people really don't understand how the Global South works. It's not the UK, it's not the US, and just dump them on us, you know, and just not taking any responsibility, no follow-ups. So you really have to be careful, because once they're in our care, we're not going to put them back on the streets if we know they're not going to survive. If we've taken that skill away from them, then you can't put that decision on somebody who's already, you know, overextended. We don't have the heart to do it anymore. And we just keep going despite being stretched thin. And then there's the other type of tourist that like takes a picture at the airport and goes like, oh, I saw this dog yesterday. Please
rescue. Like 5 days ago. No location.
Where? Why? The dog's fine firstly. He's just sleeping. why are we rescuing this dog?
But he's skinny.
So, yeah, it's really lots of different challenges. And I think even within the rescue community, and I know you're in Greece and we have people in the UK. I've worked with people in Germany when I was there. I've worked with people in France and the US. I think it's just so different, you know, in each country, the challenges and the experiences and the vet skill sets are so different that... Yeah, I think it's great that you're doing this because it really helps understand perspectives and it brings together this small group of people that really understands TNR. And I think there's more of us out there. I think it's just that people don't understand how to do it. I didn't understand how to do it, you know, 10 years ago.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's really important that we do understand it deeply and understand the effects of our actions. A lot of what I've heard you say today is about making a responsible commitment, and everybody can take part in that. It could be, you know, people who live in the community. It can be us as rescuers to the animals or to ourselves. It could be other organizations about making a responsible commitment that results in really good decision-making, that results in better future sustainable work, focus on spay and neuter and prevention.
Absolutely, yes.
Is there anything else you would like to share as a final takeaway or any final words? And if you can once again shout out where people can find your work, please.
I think my final words would be to do your best and to read a lot. There's a lot of medical veterinary literature out there. Don't read clickbait articles and influencer material. Actually read the science a little bit. Speak to people who've been doing this for a long time and take emotional decisions, but also take logical decisions and understand what you're committing to. Not helping an animal doesn't make you a bad person. But if you've committed to them, then try your best to have them properly. Yeah, socials are DOD_spay_neuter. That's the correct social.
Cool.
Yeah,
we'll definitely
thank you.
Link it below.
Yes.
Thank you for sharing that. Yeah, we really love being inspired by incredible work and people such as yours. And thank you so much for joining us on this adventure. We're really excited about it. And we would really love to hear from everybody else. So feel free to send us a DM on either Saving Lives with 2 A's or Travel Animal Rescue on Instagram. See you all at our next episode. And in the meantime, stay out of trouble and keep trapping to save the streets one animal at a time.
Let's Talk Pets every week on demand, only on PetLifeRadio.com.